listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So I am delighted to welcome tonight two writers who both have had a long history with Aloud and the Los Angeles Public Library, helping us over the years to wrestle with divisions in our city, in our country, in the world, in our souls. In his early memoir, The Hunger of Memory, which is part of his extraordinary trilogy on class, ethnicity, and race, Richard Rodriguez offered us a great literary autobiography. And in his newest book, Darling, set on the post-9/11 global stage, we accompany him on a hang-on-to-your-hat journey through his spiritual autobiography, as Richard Rodriguez turns his colossal imagination toward the desert, the birthplace of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Take the title essay, Darling, which plumbs a term of endearment common to spouses and lovers. But who else but Richard Rodriguez could cover in just two paragraphs Irish nuns, Afghan village women, and the clothing designer Balenciaga? The way he arranges and disarranges words and ideas releases meanings never encountered anywhere else. From the Sisters of Mercy to the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, from Catholic doctrine to Costco, Rodriguez dissects his complicated relationship to religion and to Catholicism. He illuminates his deep belief that were the female gender to control reproduction, or as he puts it, if the menses were the parable, not seed, I love that line, then women would gain the power to control our point of view, to reshape the paradigm from warfare and conquest to, quote, protective imagination. Through images and stories radically braided together, the reader travels with Rodriguez from Jerusalem to Times Square. We'll meet Palestinian hotel clerks as well as famous atheists like Dorothy Day. The poet W.H. Auden makes an appearance in his bedroom slippers. Mother Teresa and Christopher Hitchens rub shoulders. There's a visit to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and a hospital vigil in a hospital room in Las Vegas. Both are holy places. Richard Rodriguez writes that it was the great director Federico Fellini who taught him the hope of magic, who shared the human need for marvels. I think of Richard Rodriguez in the same way, giving us hope for both words and thought, for living ideas that can change the course of events as both a believer in and a creator of marvels. And in conversation with Richard tonight is another great thinker and writer, Ruben Martinez. Ruben's friendship with Richard goes back over 20 years, and his writing, too, plumbs the significance of the desert in ways both spiritual and political. Ruben is a professor of literature and writing at Loyola Marymount University and the author most recently of Desert America, A Journey Across Our Most Divided Landscape. Please join me in welcoming Richard Rodriguez and Ruben Martinez. Thank you so much.
Good evening. Good evening, Richard.
Good evening.
Actually, I thought long and hard about how I should greet you tonight, and I think there really is only one appropriate way to begin the evening to address you, and that would be by saying, hello, darling.
Hello, sweetie.
And now that we've started off in that swell way, congratulations on this beautiful book,
Thank you, first of all.
Have you all seen it?
Louise is very sweet, but it's a very strange book. It's a book too literary for the pious and too pious for the literary. So it struggles to find its audience.
But a really literary
Baptist would be what I'm looking for.
Okay. Well, why don't we start by delving into one central aspect of it, which is the title. The Darling is a chapter for which the book is named. And you address a woman as Darling. I don't believe her name is ever fully revealed to us.
She's never named.
She is ill, is part of her
narrative. I didn't know that at the time. She was taking medications. Mm-hmm. We were having lunch in Malibu on the day her divorce was finalized. And I had put us both in a restaurant called the Garden of Eden. There's something that happens with writing, and you know this as a writer, and certainly as a teacher of writing, is that sometimes characters or topics take you to places you don't expect to go. When I originally had titled this manuscript, The Desert God, because I was quite taken after September 11th with the fact that these men had come out of the desert and that religion, the Abrahamic religions, Judaism and Christianity and Islam, were desert religions, and that God, the God of Abraham, had revealed himself in the desert, not in the Swiss Alps, not in the south of France, not in the Costa Rican rainforest, but in the desert. Why the desert is the question that I posed to myself. And gradually what happened was that I was more and more taken, and notice the formulation, I was taken by the notion that these Abrahamic religions are obsessed with generative sex, sex that creates children, precisely the male line.
Fecundity in a place where there's an absence of it.
That's right. In a place of great dryness, there is this dry old man, Abraham, promised fertility. And it seems to me that what happened in the course of writing this book is that the woman emerges as a larger figure in my imagination, as the central figure. I'm a Christian who has a deep affinity with Judaism. I've studied Judaism. I've studied with people like Abraham Heschel, the great rabbi in New York, in the last years of his life at Jewish Theological Seminary. But I'd never had a relationship with Islam. Didn't know Islam. I'd never read the Quran before September 11th. And so this journey was both a journey toward the stranger. And then, oddly enough, as a Hispanic, I began to hear in Arabic, shadows of Spanish. And then I thought, oh, that's interesting. I'd heard that in Swahili. I thought, the first time I heard Swahili, I thought, oh, they're speaking, there's a lot of Spanish in Swahili. And they said, no, that's Arabic. And I realized that there is something like 3,000 to 4,000 Spanish words which are Arabic in derivation.
Most of the words begin with A-L, for
that's
example.
Right. Right? And names, mm-hmm. like Alvarez, you know, all you have to do is put a little hyphen after the A-L, and, mm-hmm. and then you're transported on this magic carpet to another place, you know, Alvarez, you know. Uh-huh. Oh, we think to ourselves, a terrorist, you know. Mr. Alvarez, you know. We'd always thought that you were a gardener, you know.
Right.
But.
And every Mexican child, one of the first words they hear, of course, is ojalá.
Ojalá.
Ojalá. And we didn't know that we were uttering
the name of Allah. Right now in Kuala Lumpur, a Catholic priest is under arrest because the president of Kuala Lumpur, who is also the head of the Muslim faith there, has made a law that declares that only Muslims can use the name of Allah. It is in Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, a common habit for Indonesian Christians to refer to God as Allah. Much to the chagrin and the displeasure of Muslims. But there was my mother in Sacramento in the 1950s. Ojalá, it's not going to rain today. Ojalá, which means basically, let's hope that. Mm-hmm. Ojalá, you're not going to be late after school the way you were yesterday. Ojalá, the money I've given you for lunch, you're not going to lose, and so forth. And there was suddenly my mother in Egypt reminding me that I am related to these people etymologically and probably.
Even as during your childhood, in which you describe in the early in the first chapter here, the Ojalá chapter, you're watching the Orient being screened for you by Hollywood.
Yes.
You talk about Otto Preminger giving you the Orient through the blue eyes of Paul Newman.
Paul Newman, yes,
as it were.
In Exodus.
So on the one hand, your tongue, your ears and your tongue are becoming intimate with the stranger, right? But at the same time, Hollywood is pushing you away into this fantasy realm.
To some degree, Hollywood was doing that. The great theater of my childhood in Sacramento was a theater called the Alhambra Theater. Right. Already, there it is.
Right.
We are in Sevilla, and there are gardens outside the Alhambra Theater. I saw Grace Kelly at the Alhambra Theater. I saw Gwen Verdon at the Alhambra Theater. But I also saw the Middle East at the Alhambra, Bible movies. And it was within that fantasy. So much of those early movie theaters were constructed upon the memory, largely because of the success of The Sheik and Rudolph Valentino, of Spanish Arabia. Mm-hmm. And so the Alcazar and the Alhambra, these theaters that were which were once common, that's really where I got my education about the desert. Many years later, I would see Lawrence of Arabia, and then I really would see the desert that I would later see in Saudi Arabia, the enormity of that vacancy and the shocking emptiness. And then it would occur to me to wonder, in religious terms, why a God would reveal himself that way. Every Christmas, and I notice that Christmas tree is still up in Pershing Square, every Christmas I will get these Christmas cards that will have the baby Jesus in what looks like the Swiss Alps. There will be these right. these Christmas trees yes. that twinkle in the back of him.
Yes.
And I think to myself, that isn't the way it was at all. It was, you either portray him being born in the desert, or you portray him being born more likely in a cave in the desert. I don't think that I'd really considered that implication mm-hmm. until I wrote this book. Mm-hmm. I think in that way, the book surprises you, that it was in Cairo that I really had a sense among the Egyptians that these people were not foreign to me.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about the desert in the sense that you'd make a pilgrimage yourself into the desert after this childhood of the combination of the fantasy and hearing the bits of the language coming through the Spanish of your mother. As an adult now, you make the pilgrimage to the Holy Lands themselves. It takes up a good part of the book. And you have a curious experience of looking, or being both a pilgrim, but also a tourist. And everywhere you seem to go, whether it's the Church of the Nativity or the Holy Sepulchre, the closer you are to the place, it seems the further you are from the deity.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, the great paradox of the desert is that it's not there. And so when you say, I've been to the desert today, it is truly a kind of Samuel Beckett assertion. I've been to nowhere. The desert is, by definition, deserted. So when I have been to a place that's deserted, it is at least a paradox. But my shoes are dusty. And when I blow my nose, there's sand in my sinus. And when I wash my hands, the water is brown. Oh, I've been to the desert today, I say to myself. But the desert kept perplexing me, because everywhere I looked, it was there. And nowhere I looked was it there. I mean, this was not the desert. This was, by extension, many, many millions of times the desert. But by very definition, it was absence. And that's what interested me. Mm-hmm. I must say that preoccupation with place, as a Roman Catholic, realizing that I was not Roman at all, that I was a desert Catholic, and as someone who was raised by American history books to believe in English Puritans, I realized that they were desert Puritans, and Greek Orthodox were desert Orthodox, and so forth. That I began to realize that even these Abrahamic religions really haven't quite confronted the desert. And then the boast of modern Israel is that we have made the desert bloom, not that we live in the desolation, which is how Ben-Gurion refers to the desert that the first settlers found, but the planting becomes a metaphor for nationhood, making the place green. Well, it did occur to me, and again, it came to me, that what I was dealing with here was some large difficulty that we have with our bodies, with living in our bodies, with being in this place at this time, here in Los Angeles, downtown, And it was not simply the religions that I was thinking about, but increasingly as America has become more anti-theist, less inclined toward the Abrahamic religions. I was in Santa Barbara last night, and I swear to you that in this really, really sweet audience of grandmothers, that most of them thought of themselves as Buddhists in some way. Although the Dalai Lama kept saying, don't become Buddhist, stay whatever you are, stay Methodist. But they felt Buddhist to me. They were really, really sweet and unoffended by my ludicrous assertions. But it seemed to me that one of the things that we are struggling with as modern people right now is exactly what religionists struggle with, and that is the place. I pointed in three chapters to this difficulty. One of them, of course, is the easiest one, this reversion to technology, this distraction, this absorption in the screen, to a point at which I'm not looking where I'm walking, where I'm driving, where I plunge into the sea.
I was going to use my iPad tonight, but I brought the hard copy out just for you.
And that seems to me already a kind of movement away from place that's really interesting
abstraction.
Right now.
Virtual abstraction.
The second one was, I write an obituary for an American newspaper. We're no longer interested in Peoria, living in Peoria. We watch MSNBC or Fox News to find out, the only conversation Americans seem to have is about Washington.
Can I pause for just 1 second? Do you realize what a journey we've been on just in the last 5 minutes? What Louise's wonderful introduction, she was talking about something that I've noticed in New York for a long time, which I wrote a review of your book, and I used the term radical digressiveness. And I'm not sure that's actually right. I'm not sure if you would use that word yourself. But I just wanted to pause and notice the ease with which you move through intellectual space. Where do these myriad points
because,
of reference and
we are alive,
this fluidity come from?
Because we are alive, and everything in our lives is pertinent to the meaning of our lives. So that I saw Elvis Presley in Las Vegas in 1972, and he's in this book, in the same way that St. Augustine is, because they're both part of my experience of the desert. And everything, you know, there's that wonderful line which Flannery O'Connor uses.
Now, you got a laugh line there.
But I'm not paying attention to it. I'm really...
Was the laughter because they're wondering how the desert brings them together?
Well, because for one thing, St. Augustine is from North Africa. For another thing, Elvis Presley was singing in the middle of the desert about and drinking Gatorade when a woman stood up in the International Hotel and she said, Elvis, I'm your mother, his mother having been dead by that time. And Elvis was, this was between sets, Elvis looks at her and these Filipino bodyguards come out of nowhere and take her away. Well, that chapter on Las Vegas is a chapter on yet another digression. Mm-hmm. And it is these new desert cities that are built on the evasion of the desert, that Las Vegas has transported the Eiffel Tower, the Pyramid, Lago Como, because everything is movable in the world in which Las Vegas operates, and because there is no place. Do you understand?
Yes.
And so, you're struck now with the influence of Las Vegas in the Middle East, in places like Dubai, where you have ice palaces in Dubai, where you have water slides in Dubai, where the lady at the hotel says, we're going to upgrade you, and she takes you to the 180th floor of this hotel, and you can look at the desolation from the 180th floor. And there's all of this horizontal line of the desert is being challenged by these enormous constructions, these vertical constructions against the horizontal line. Now even in the Emirates, you see it everywhere, but now even in Mecca, a city I cannot go to as a Christian, there is the being built by the engineering architecture firm of Osama bin Laden's father, Bin Laden Associates, these constructions around Mecca that mimic Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. In fact, opposite the Kaaba, where Muslims are required once in their life to visit, on the Hajj, and to walk around. There is a Fairmont Hotel of some magnitude that is built in the shape of Big Ben. Now, not even Las Vegas has thought of that yet. let's have a hotel built in the shape of Big Ben. Well, that's the second digression. The third is get back to Peoria before you so rudely interrupted me. poor old Peoria doesn't want to be in Peoria anymore. And so nobody wants to read the daily newspaper in Peoria. And so I write an obituary for a newspaper that still exists, barely, my own San Francisco Chronicle. When I was born in San Francisco, there was notation made of that fact, of my birth, in the newspaper, as there was with most babies. Now, increasingly, friends of mine die, and they do not want obituaries in the paper. I note that in that chapter, and I also note the fact that increasingly in America, it's one of those odd things that you see now, but you see it so often that no one bothers to remark on it. I remember a few years ago when I started noticing that as women were wearing pants, men were exposing their legs with shorts. And I thought, that's interesting, you know, but no one was talking about it. So all these guys are walking around in shorts, and all these women are walking around in jeans, you know, and you don't see their legs, but you see his hairy legs, okay? Mm-hmm. Well, it seemed to me that one of the things that was going on in America that was really interesting, and I began to see this with my friends, is that friends were not being buried anymore. They were being cremated, and then their ashes were being thrown to the wind, under a redwood tree, on a lake, and there was this...
Another way in which place is dying.
There was an invasion of the city of the dead. Mm-hmm. We will not live there. We will not go to visit...
Which was never a comfortable place for Americans to be in the first place.
Well, but it was a place... I mean, it was a place where... I mean, I certainly...
I mean, our cities of the dead are nothing like the Latin Catholic cities of the dead of
No,
Mexico.
Nothing like that.
I mean,
But you go to the cemeteries in San Francisco, and there's certainly Chinese mending, attending those graves. And there are... You know, my mother and father are not far from Joe DiMaggio in the Catholic cemetery in San Francisco. We were at a Jewish... A cemetery in San Francisco, an old woman we knew, Ahuva, died, and there were only three of us at her funeral, and we walked with her coffin to the hole in the ground where her body would be buried. And there was, over there, there was Bill Graham's tombstone, the Rock...
Impresario,
yeah. And over here was a Jewish family whose name I recognized. You know, it was like visiting this neighborhood of the dead. And it was quite moving in that sense. Increasingly, I have a friend who dies, a priest, an ex-priest, who against his objections initially, allows me to have a funeral for him, to which hundreds of people come. He died suddenly of cancer, and lots of priest friends come, and lots of other friends come. And then he has directed two women friends of his to take his ashes to a place, but not to tell anybody where it is. I don't know what the secrecy is. I don't know what happens out there. But a student of his calls me about 2 weeks later and says, I was one of his students. He changed my life. I would like to visit his grave and pay my respects. And I said, I would like to visit his life and pay my respects. I don't know where he is. I don't know where he is. That evasion of place, that refusal to be in the ground, seems to me really interesting right now. The last one I talk about, be quiet. The last one is this. I was watching Oprah Winfrey one day. I take a nap usually in late afternoon. This was when Oprah was still on at 4 o'clock. Now it's Judge Judy. but I was watching Oprah, and she had Bono on, and here are these two extremely talented, extremely wealthy people talking about how we have to all make the world more green. And then they get in their private jets and go somewhere else to tell us all to make the world green. And I thought to myself, having read Keats on Autumn, his wonderful poem on Autumn, I thought to myself, I don't really think of nature as being green. Most of the world is brown. And the most prolific ecology in the world right now is the desert. The desert is spreading faster than any other ecology we know. And even in those places where nature is green in the spring and the summer, it becomes brown in the fall. That is its fullness, the autumn, the moment of harvest when we celebrate the whole process. And then the planting begins again, and with the stillness of winter. Do these people not want to celebrate the brown of winter? Is that not part of their agenda? And it did seem to me that there was now, in this modern ecological dream of green, we have to throw this away in a place that, you know, is it in a blue casket or in a green one? Or, in, you know, which one of these baskets do I put this thing in? There is this, it's almost a parody of the religious dream of Eden, that we want to return to this green place in a brown world. At the end of that chapter, which is called Transit Alexander, Hamlet, tiresome Hamlet, the most tiresome character in all of Shakespeare, is going on to Horatio, who is the most patient of all Ruben Martinez's in all of history. Horatio is listening, rather the way you are listening, to Hamlet,
That's Hamlet carrying on.
And Hamlet is going on about the death of Alexander the Great and how Alexander the Great has come to mud, from mud to mud. And from that mud was a cork made, which now plugs up a beer barrel. And for Hamlet, of course, this the great of the death of this great man, of Alexander the Great, and his relegation to this fate of being a cork, is more testimony to his morbidity and to his depression. What I would have said to Hamlet if I had been a Horatio is that the end is as much the beginning as it is the conclusion, and that in almost all the great religions of the world, they begin with the creation as mud, and from that mud comes the cycle.
Of course, clay.
And this intricate notion of the seasons does not allow for us to, oh, let's just freeze frame here, an April day with young lovers under the tree. We're going to say this is nature. That is not.
It's kind of like an ecological nativism of a kind.
Exactly.
Well, now, Richard, clearly you're just projecting your own brown skin onto the entire universe here.
But I don't. I don't.
Your ethnic pride just spills over onto the entire natural realm.
One of the reasons I wore an orange shirt today was because I think of this as Aztec orange. Actually, I don't think of this as brown. Well, I wrote an essay in Newsweek magazine when he was elected, celebrating the fact that our president was our first brown president, Barack Obama. We had at last our first brown president, which in many ways was more provocative than our first black president, because the prohibition against black-white relations was always the fear that Mrs. Obama and Mr. Obama, Kansas and Kenya, would have a baby that would be brown.
Right.
And we still do not know who those Jefferson children were behind the great house at Monticello. So I wrote this piece in Newsweek, which is now dead, of course, and our first brown president, hooray! And of course, at the first census that Barack Obama observed in the White House, he marked black. So much for Newsweek magazine.
Let's run with brown for a little bit. It's your favorite color. You had a book called Brown. You've been writing about brown since your first book, if I'm not mistaken. I think you invoke brown in Hunger of Memory. It's the color, as you just in your dissertation just now. It's the color of life itself. Even if it's the end of life, it's still life, right? And it becomes the fertilizer for more life.
That's right. Right? You go visit. You know, I'm in this.
I wasn't done with
this. In this monastery.
But you're just going to go on.
A Greek Orthodox monastery. Saint Sabas is downstairs, they say.
Yes.
And would you like to see Saint Sabas, who died in the 7th century, and he's here, they say. Almost as though you would say, you know, Ruben is here. And the monk takes you with his little flashlight. And there in a glass case is Saint Sabas. And he runs this flashlight from his head to his feet. He's dressed in these vestments, this great saint of the Orthodox churches. And he's this little brown man.
Right.
Like this. And this is preservation.
Yes.
Yes. Go ahead with your question.
Yes. Thank you. This morning, at breakfast with the Archbishop, this is what I usually do. I breakfast with the Archbishop very often. At the Biltmore Hotel, just right here, Pershing Square. The Archbishop, his name is Jose Gomez. He's from Monterrey, not Monterrey on the Central Coast, but Monterrey, Mexico. So in one sense, he's a sign of, you know, Los Angeles. What Los Angeles, his name is not, it's not Cardinal McIntyre, it's not Cardinal Manning, it's not Cardinal Dolan, right? He's not a cardinal yet, but he will be. His name is Gomez, and he's brown. And he has a brown tongue, as you would say, because you can hear his accent still. So he's talking about immigration. And he gives the usual kind of like, it was not a great speech, I would say, forgive me, Your Excellency, about immigration, the platitudes about immigration. Immigrants, we are a nation of immigrants. There's a table of African Americans next to me. And during the question and answer session, they lay into the Archbishop.
Okay.
And they say, what are you going to do about what's happened to our place in Los Angeles? We have been displaced.
To which he says,
we have been this, we have been that. A Chicano activist stands up and says, but we're treated like second-class citizens. And I winced, because imagine the African-American elder hearing the brown,
lament.
Now brown here in another context,
yes,
right?
Yes.
The brown man, the Mexican man, saying that he's being treated like a second-class citizen. And we're in the city of Los Angeles, the city of Watts. I present this to you as an American comedy, maybe, what happened this morning. What do you make of it?
I don't make a lot of it. I do think the world is in movement right now. And I think one of the things that interests me right now, this is slightly different from what you're asking. In the United States, this immigration really does have religious implications. Christianity would be in decline were it not for immigrants. They are filling the churches, and not simply the established Christian churches like Catholicism, but increasingly evangelical Protestantism is Latino. The world population of the Mormon church now, in its majority, is Latino. As Moroni, the angel Moroni, predicted, there is this, and this Pope seems to me part of this wave coming north from the south of spiritual renewal that is really something. That on the one hand. But in Europe, I am noticing.
Oh, he's a curious agent of change, Bergoglio.
Because
right?
He's very conservative.
Light-skinned Italian immigrants coming to Argentina. I mean, the story is brown in many different ways.
Well, but it's very brown to touch a wounded child and to caress his face. Saint Francis, after whom he's named, is a story which I tell in the book about Francis in Assisi. There were lepers on the road, and they would have these pebbles in a gourd making noise to warn against their arrival, so that anybody who would hear the noise would step away from them. Well, that's what Francis does. And he goes in off the path, and then he stops. And he comes back. And he comes face to face with the leper and touches him. And I think to myself, oh, this is where it begins, this contact with impurity. I think this Pope is part of that tradition, and to be admired for that. But I also think that religiously what's going on in Europe right now is increasingly the Islamicization of Europe, if I can use that grotesque word. Certainly in Spain, for example, I will hear young Muslims say that numerically this conquest, or what they call the Reconquista, will not come with Chicano activists ending up in Phoenix, Arizona, but will come with this, with two things. The childlessness of Europe, of Europeans, the decline of Europe, the negative birth rates throughout Europe, and these immigrants who are coming in now from the Middle East, from Africa.
Which is a narrative not unlike the United States.
Except that you are now in America on this stage, people like Christopher Hitchens, for example. Americans have this obsession with England. I used to say I don't understand it, but I guess I do understand it.
He has a problem with the British atheists.
Well, no, I have a problem.
Dawkins, Hitchens,
what I have a problem with is reality television, where, you know, I've lived in England, and I know what the English food is like, that it's all overcooked. And it's charming, but it's overcooked. It's not French, it's not Italian. And yet, on reality television, they always have an Englishman. They're berating some poor Italian woman in a New Jersey restaurant for how she cooks her spaghetti. What the English know about any of that, I don't understand. And then Vogue magazine has this woman with bangs. She's been there for some time. And she's another English woman. The only people who really think about beauty in interesting ways are Italians and French. And yet this English woman sits in New York. Well, there was Christopher Hitchens, bringing to us the news of the new atheism.
Rest in peace, Christopher.
Rest in peace. Well, the other one, Dickie Dawkins, his little associate. Dickie Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens with their Oxbridge accents, which really, I mean, Cary Grant was one thing, but these guys really talk fancy. And we Americans, wow, they must know something, okay? So Chrissy Hitchens comes to America, comes to the stage, and tells us that God is not great.
This is really curious.
Wait a minute.
Colonial, this is hilarious. I love
God
this.
Is not great. Yes. And a deliberate affront against Islam, okay? All right, so let that pass. He tells us that God is not great and that religion is in decline, but the religion is not in decline in London. London is becoming more Muslim and more Hindu as we breathe.
It's in decline at Oxford, but
yes.
Not in Rotten.
At the same time, this is to, in some way, insinuate. I mean, one of the most interesting things that has happened in America, mainly because of abortion and gay rights, is that the left has essentially ceded religion to the right wing. We don't talk about religion. Even though I grew up in a Black civil rights movement, when Martin Luther King Jr. gave a sermon at the Washington Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial, which he talked about.
But weren't we pushed into the left by the religious conservatives that
allowed
rode
that. I
on
think,
abortion
I
and gay rights
allowed,
and now the Pope?
I think we allowed that to happen. I think we ceded religion to the religious right. Let me finish the story. Okay. So Christopher Hitchens comes. He romances the left with his atheism, and then he romances the right with his defense of the Iraq War. Okay, this war, which is designed to uphold these lines in the desert, which were established by the Foreign Office in London. Okay, by Winston Churchill. Okay. I never understood why Tony Blair was called the poodle of George Bush. I think George Bush was the poodle of Tony Blair. I think Americans were upholding a British design on the desert, and I still think that to this day. In any case, it seems to me that one of the most interesting things that's happened right now is that I open up my Vanity Fair magazine when I still want to know something about Madonna that I haven't already learned. and there was that Joan Didion's brother-in-law, what's his name, Dominic Dunn, going on about some murder in the Côte d'Azur or someplace or something. And all these perfume ads will fall on my floor. And I see in Vanity Fair magazine, where else, that Mother Teresa, in Christopher Hitchens' opinion, is ugly. That's what he said about her. This Macedonian old woman is ugly. And I thought, oh, that's sort of interesting. You know, that's like the boys wearing the shorts and the women wearing the long pants. Mm-hmm. And it's public English,
sold them a lot of books.
English public school humor. An American writer would not say that about an old nun like that. I don't care what you think of Mother Teresa. At the end of this book, Mother Teresa and Christopher Hitchens are both present in the last ecology. There are three ecologies of the desert I talked about. One is the mountaintop, which Martin Luther King Jr. talked about. I have been to the mountaintop.
The prophet.
The desert floor, the plain of Kvetch. You know, when are we going to get there? You know, are we there yet,
years.
Mama? You know, and the cave. Everything happens in the cave in the Middle East.
St. Anthony.
One of the things that St. Anthony, yes. One of the things that happens with desert people is that they discover that the most treacherous time for the eye, is noonday. And since there are no sunglasses, there's no Armani sunglasses, you do this in the desert, and there are dust storms, and there's mirage, and you don't know whether you're seeing what you're seeing. It is only at twilight, when the light descends, that you begin to think and to see. Muhammad has his visions in a cave. Jesus is born in a cave and is resurrected in a cave. Moses is put in a cave by God so as not to be blinded by his magnificence. It is everywhere there. Mother Teresa, in the last 40 years of her life, when she became famous, was struggling with religion, was struggling with faith. And she would see the other nuns and at prayer, and she would not. She was dry. And she writes in her letters, Christopher Hitchens, who became our favorite British atheist, mocks her for her atheism, calls her a hypocrite. But I think at that moment that he doesn't understand how much unbelief is part of the experience of religion, how there are seasons of belief and unbelief in any religious person's life. And rather, he portrays atheism, which is, I think, a noble and very fine intellectual and philosophical tradition. He portrays it as a fundamentalism, mm-hmm. a kind of blindness to all sense of mystery. And he, the two of them end their lives, not so separated in years, but the interesting thing about hers is that she often describes herself as in a tunnel, the light far away and the darkness surrounding her. When she dies in Calcutta, she dies in a bed at the convent, and the grid goes black. The lights turn off in Calcutta. There are two emergency generators in the room. The old nun is breathing with difficulty. One of the generators is turned on. Bang, it goes off. The other generator is turned on, it goes off. She dies in the dark. And I think to myself, this is the way the book ends. I think to myself, how magnificent that is, that for a religious life to end in that kind of darkness. Mm-hmm. I once
desert
saw...
Desert darkness.
In the desert darkness. You have been in the desert at night. You know two things. One is that it's very black out there and that the stars are everywhere. And when God promises Abraham descendants as numerous as the stars, or more numerous than the stars, he's talking about that desert sky, which is numerous indeed. In many ways, that becomes the anti-desert sky, because at night, what you realize is just how much universe there is. In the daylight, when that panoply is lost to you, you can only see the sand.
Yes. Yes, I share with you to an extent the experience of the desert. I lived in the desert for many years and have written about it in a different vein. But also,
are you afraid of it?
Am I afraid of the desert?
Yeah.
No, I seek it out. I walk into it. I want to walk across that burning plain.
What do you think that intuition is? Do you think that's genetic in you?
It's before language or after language. And the irony, of course, is that you wrote a book. A book is made of words. But the words, there's a moment, I can't remember which shrine you're at, the Western Wall. I think you're at the Western Wall. And you're writing in your notebook.
No, I'm not writing. A woman sees that I have a pen in my hand.
Yes.
And Magen Broshi, who's an anthropologist of some distinction in Israel, he's with me. And she says, there's no writing here, no writing here. She said, it's on the Sabbath. Right. And I thought, is there no writing at any time, or is there no writing here? Because it's the Sabbath. It's the Sabbath.
But the symbolic import is much greater than that.
Magen says to her, he's not writing anything.
Right. Which, yeah, once again, hinting at the ineffable. Not hinting at it. It is the ineffable. We can't name what the destination is in the desert. We look into the empty mirror and there's no words to describe.
Except
what
we
is
do.
There.
I mean, one of the interesting things about writing is that we keep finding words. Or looking
to write
for
about
words
what we can't write about.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
I mean, one of the most interesting experiences of teaching young students to write is that most of the most intense experiences are, as we say, beyond words. You know, fear, ecstasy, whatever that is. And the experience of trying to give a word to the emptiness, like the emptiness, or the void, or the desert, is in some sense a contradiction.
Yes.
But it is also, I think it's a necessity. One of the things about these religions is that they are religions of the book, all of them. And I know Steve Jobs to be praised. I know I was at a play the other night in New York, the Glass Menagerie, and talk about the fantasy of this girl with this little glass menagerie. There was a woman sitting next to me in the second row who pulled out in the middle of the act her cell phone. An older woman, not a teenage, a New Jersey girl, but an older woman from Park Avenue, it looked like, and to check her messages in the middle of the play. And I thought, oh, so it goes on. In the desert, the book, the weight of it is its meaning. You understand, this is not Kindle. The weight of it is its meaning. If I ever go to a bar mitzvah, when the kid comes in with a Torah on a Kindle, I will walk out. I promise I will not stay. But the weight of it is its entrance into history. You understand? The
yes.
The eternal has entered the temporal. So that the very word, you kiss it, you hold it.
It makes the place.
You dance with it, yes.
And without the newspaper, with the death of the newspaper, we start losing the place. With no obituary, with no cemetery.
Two GIs are in Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. And they have been tweeting their mourning away to their girlfriends in Phoenix, Arizona. What do they know of this? They're post-religious, or they're into some other zone. They're not even, they're post-Buddhist. They tweet a lot. and they see in the prison library a Quran. And the Quran, on the margin, there are these notations in Arabic, a language they cannot decipher. And they suspect that the prisoners are exchanging messages in the Quran. They take this book, the Quran, and they heave it into the flames. And at that moment, of course, there is a conflagration in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Nuns are killed in North Africa. Priests are killed in Egypt. I don't think we understand what we are dealing with here as we look at our Kindle. We are dealing with a revolution. Clearly enough, our society is becoming post-word or post-text, I'll say. But there are places in Saudi Arabia where the kids are today, are this moment, memorizing the Quran. And it is part of them. And we don't know anything of that difference. It may end up that, I have several scenarios for the end of the world. One of them is that, it's, as September 11th suggested, is that the world may end with a prayer. Those terrorists were praying at the last minute before those 757s hit the World Trade Center. It may also end up that the world could end with a literary misunderstanding, that I didn't understand what this book was. I didn't understand what its weight was to you.
Right. Well, I was about to ask you, what's at stake in the desert? And I think you just answered that question, and 9/11 answered that question, and so much else, right?
I think the desert does make you mad. I think there is a kind of madness in the desert. And I think Las Vegas is a perfectly good indication of it. I think there is something in that place. But one of the things that happens in the Las Vegas chapter is that I have a friend who is dying in Las Vegas, and four miles from the Strip, which, by the way, is not in Las Vegas. The Strip is in a place in Nevada called Paradise, Nevada, curiously enough. It's zoned out of Las Vegas for tax purposes. So all of these hotels are in Paradise. But four
the
miles,
earthly paradise.
Yes, for 4 miles away from Paradise, there is this hospice where my friend is dying. And it is among the best hospices. I've been to lots of hospices in my life, and I'll probably end up in one. But my friend is dying in a room that almost mocks the vast spaces of Las Vegas, because it is a vast space. And there is a sofa, there's a bed for his lover to hold his hand in the night, there is permission to bring a family pet in. It's really quite extraordinary. And you move between that, Las Vegas in its real life, what people in Las Vegas kept saying to me, the real Las Vegas, where the striptease artist lives, and the other Las Vegas, where the striptease artist strips. It seems to me that dialectic between our fantasy and our reality is really interesting right now. I must say, you know, almost all of my friends are anti-theists. My brother, who describes himself that way, and I have decided not to discuss religion. We're like a Victorian family, or like a family in a James Joyce short story. We don't talk religion at the Christmas table anymore. But
you, as the keeper of the theist tradition, have thrown your lot in with the immigrants the world, right? I mean the evangelical storefront just a couple of miles from here.
You haven't said, because you're too discreet, is that I'm a gay keeper of the tradition.
Right.
And these religions find me, even this Pope who says, you know, who am I to judge? We spend too much time talking about abortion and gay marriage, he says.
Yes.
But he never says why we have spent so much time. He never says why Jerry Falwell, shortly after September 11th, said that the wrath of God had come down on New York and the Pentagon, not because of religious terrorists, but because of feminists and gays. And there that was that link again. One of the things I argue in the chapter, darling, is that women have been my liberation. I dedicate this book to the Sisters of Mercy, the Irish nuns who came many, many thousands of miles to shove the English language down my throat. They were the first feminists of my life. They established hospitals, orphanages, and schools all over America. And they anticipated a larger emancipation of people like my mother, who later became women who ventured on the street and got jobs and so forth.
Like my mother, who is here in the audience tonight, as a matter of fact, who made the journey from El Salvador to San Francisco in 1957, Mom? 1957? Yes.
Yes.
Vilma Angulo, who met my father on the streets of Los Angeles. That preceded us.
That, you know, it seems to me that you know, I love New York. Can I say I love New York enough for you to believe that I love New York? I would do a commercial that says I love New York. but New York is just this teeny little bitsy bit provincial, okay? So I have for years heard that the gay movement began with the Stonewall riots in Greenwich Village, okay? And, I didn't know that, okay? I didn't know that. But I guess it started in Greenwich Village, and everything starts in New York, okay? And then it occurred to me that maybe that wasn't quite the case. Maybe the women's movement in Europe, I mean the suffragettes of the late 19th century and the 20th century, these women who were leaving the house, leaving the parlor, to go out in the street to parade, often got themselves arrested, moving into the streets, demanding that they be acknowledged, not as somebody's wife, not as somebody's mother, not as a spinster or a grandmother, but as somebody singular who was able to vote, okay? That maybe that sexual movement out of the house anticipates my own movement out of the closet. You understand?
Yes.
And I began to that's when I began to realize what my stake was in Darlene's life and her own liberation. Maybe my liberation comes second to that, that in the wake of that, I'm doing a TV essay for the NewsHour on Temple Square in Salt Lake City, and a Mormon lady comes up to me, and she says, they always get my name wrong. They always call me Richard Suarez, they say. sometimes it's worse. Sometimes it's Richard Ramirez, the mass murderer.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
I've just gotten out of prison, but yes, ask me your question. Anyway, she said, you know, my church teaches me that family is everything. and then my church tells me that I must reject my son, and I will not do it, she says, for the very same reason, because family is everything. I think in my life, in my own family, my own Mexican family, the word homosexual would not be possible for my parents. But it was impossible for them to reject me and to reject the man I love. And that even when my I say partner, it sounds like a law firm. When my partner would take my father to church on Saturday nights because I was traveling or something, my father just, in his Mexican way, rather routinely said, you know, you and Richard should get your own house one of these days. You should buy your own house. That was his permission, you understand? And in some way, the very strength of the family makes it impossible for us to be rejected by the family, even though we are, in other ways, posed against the family. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
Well, I find all of that our dryness. It's not that, please don't tell me about gay friends of yours who have adopted babies, or I don't want to know that. The objection of the church to gay marriage is largely that we're not generative. It is sex that is not generative. It doesn't give birth. The objection to abortion is that it doesn't give birth. You understand? It cuts birth off. These are religions based upon the increase of the tribe. You understand? St. Augustine, North African St. Augustine, says that sexual pleasure is secondary to the increase of the tribe, to the birth. That's the primary reason for sex. You understand? So that this new insistence now on populations of people who are loving each other but not giving birth to children is a problem for these religions. And I think women who themselves now are in America raising children without men in the majority are going to be the decisive figures. This Pope is too smart. He knows that women are going to be the issue that he has to face.
So you're predicting?
I'm not predicting anything. I'm already telling you what is the case. When this book was launched, it was launched in the basement of Grace Cathedral on a Sunday morning at a book event that they have at Grace Cathedral, the Episcopal Church on Nob Hill in San Francisco. I was interviewed by the dean of Grace Cathedral, who is a woman. In New York, the interviewer was at Union Theological Seminary, the large, very famous, esteemed liberal Protestant seminary on the Upper West Side of New York, interviewed by the president of the seminary, who is a woman. It is already the case. I go to Jewish funerals now, and the rabbi is a woman. I'm seeing history already, so I'm not predicting anything. I'm telling you what I've seen. You know, one of the joys of my life was that I was an altar boy. I was on the altar as often as I was. But now it is women on the altar. And what I know about Judaism that really interests me as a Christian is that the center of the Jewish faith is not the temple, is not the synagogue, but is the house. And the woman, the mother, officiates at the table. And she carries on the tradition over food. And that tradition Christians have lost because we gave the role to the man. I think Leonardo da Vinci was wrong. I think the Last Supper did not look like that. 12 men ranged across the table. I think there were women at least serving and kvetching on the side. but I think that women are going to have to take that role as being the people who officiate. And as the Jews would say, whose line carries the line?
Well, that's what I thought you were saying. And when I asked you, are you predicting what I was imagining? And I hadn't imagined it, but imagining a woman baptizing in our church.
Yeah,
because we are of the same church.
Yeah,
and it's a church of the desert. And I'm noticing the clock. I think we want some questions from the audience. But I wanted to thank you for this radically digressive conversation and the great journey into the desert you've taken us on. You guys know about the microphones.
Mr. Rodriguez, I'm a high school teacher, English teacher, and I teach writing and I teach journalism. I'm wondering if you have any insight into reaching students. I teach in a predominantly high poverty school, just about reaching them and how to teach writing. Any ideas?
I don't have any instruction. I was recently teaching at Columbia University for 3 weeks. I hadn't taught for many years, and this was a graduate course in writing. And these people in this day and age were just brilliant writers at a time in their life when I could not predict to them that they will be able to make a living from this skill. The thing is about young people, the students I imagine you have, is that a lot of them are writing all the time. But it's like this. And I, you know, my instruction is that you teach them to understand that there is writing and there is writing, that there are forms of public writing that are very different from writing to a friend, writing to someone you know, which is a very different, it's the distinction I make in Hunger of Memory, my first book about language, that the difference in Spanish between tú and usted, you know, that there are ways of speaking to a friend that are very different. Many times, using words that you also use to speak to a stranger, but you use them with a different tone, use them with a different different informality and so forth, that you harness. There is a great interest in communication, but most of it is self-indulgent. That is, it is only self-expression. And it seems to me that what young people need to learn is not simply that I have something to say, but that the task of writing is to communicate to a stranger, to you, who have nothing at stake in this communication. How do I seduce a stranger to what I have to say? Well, you have to use his point of view. You have to use language that he can understand, and so forth. It seems to me at that level that we move away from the notion of education that prizes the individual voice, and rather prizes the capacity of the individual to take the point of view of his listener. You know what I'm saying? And at that level, it becomes a different exercise where I have to start listening to how he responds or doesn't respond to something I've said, and then I have to find words to get to him. If he's not getting what I'm saying, well, then I'll try another way, you know. Talk to me, students. Get me interested in what you're saying. I'm not going to be interested in what you're saying unless you get me interested in hearing you. You understand? And it puts the responsibility of the student not for self-expression, but rather for a communal exercise in which he begins to realize that communication begins with the stranger understanding him. And that's a very complicated
thing. Which sounds as much ethics as writing.
Yeah, it's a very moral act. This, I mean, a lot of what characterizes, I mean, hip-hop, for example, a lot of people tell me that hip-hop is a new form of self-expression. Well, it is. But the question is, is it you venting, or is it me understanding, you know? And do you care how I understand you? At that level, I think writing becomes quite different, and it becomes a social activity.
Yes, Richard. In the desert is often contrasted in these religions of the book with empire, Pharaoh. We're an empire in perhaps decline. What is the desert? Could the desert save us and some of its wisdom?
I'm not sure. I don't think an ecology or I think there is something in the desert that creates tribes. You don't live as a solitary. I mean, Ruben is an eccentric. He's like one of these Gabby Hayes characters. He goes into the desert to write his books by himself. But by and large, you don't live in the desert by yourself. It's a very, very treacherous ecology. And I know people who love the desert will say, there's so much life in the desert. The park ranger in the desert will always say, you know, there's so much life in the desert. If you come here in April, for 2 weeks there are wild flowers, you know. But come quickly because they're gonna die. And then he'll say, but make sure to wear sunblock and make sure to wear a hat and make sure to bring water with you, otherwise you're going to die, you know. So one of the things you find in the desert is they're very tribal. because I only exist by virtue of the tribe. I exist in the plural sense. And in that way, they are always, always interested in the numerical growth. One of the most interesting things about Islam right now is that it, we make, and much of the Muslim world equates Islam with the Arab. And that, in fact, most of the insurrection now going on in Africa, a lot of it is inspired by or paid for by Arab money. And it, that Islam now is inseparable from a pan-Arabism. And I, you know, a lot of Indonesia is the largest Muslim country in the world. And a lot of Indonesians will tell you, but I'm not Arab. And I believe as a Muslim, I'm not an Arab, but that doesn't make me an Arab, you understand? But we are in a phase right now where Arabs really are, there is this, I think, a pan-Arabism at stake in this insurrection now in Syria, in Lebanon, in so much of the Middle East, there is this this dream of expanding the Arabia and even to the gates of Vienna, as on September 11th, many centuries ago, where Islam came to the gates of Europe. It seems to me that I would almost call it a blasphemy that the equation of a nationality with religion is extremely dangerous, and it establishes a national motives to religious conversion that I'm very unsettled by. As a Christian, I must say, of course, that Christianity was often the excuse, even in California, to expand empire, and that it was supported by European governments, and that certainly European governments in Africa and the Middle East sent missionaries to convert, but also to expand empire. And this is always the tricky part of religion, its complicity with nation. That doesn't get to your question exactly. The desert is not, I think, in our salvation. I think it's the most dangerous ecology in the world right now, because it's going to make us crazy. It's going to make us anxious in a way that I think will drive us mad.
Next question right here.
Returning to the role of women in society, as you talked a little about the modern woman, but I truly appreciate what you said about the suffragette movement, which I think is historically undervalued, unappreciated, and very transformative in a lot of ways of our society,
yeah,
and really led us into the 20th century. How did you come to that parallel of equating modern women, their ability, their desire, sense of living on their own, starting to change our norm? And like the suffragette movement, are you projecting there's going to be a real transformative impact of the modern women's movement by mid-century?
I don't know how I can date the idea, but it certainly occurred to me, and it occurs to me now, you know, the man I've been with for over 30 years and I are going to get hitched. But I, thank you. But I resist calling it a marriage because I'm looking for another language. And one of the things about the feminist movement that I'm very moved by is the word Ms. I just thought Ms. was just a dazzle. That a woman could be Ms. and we didn't know whether that was Miss or Mrs. We didn't know what that was. And it was this public face which was also masked in some sense. I think that women have, maybe by a generation or two, and maybe Elizabeth Taylor used to know this when she hung out at this West Hollywood bar all the time, that women really did have a compatibility with gay culture and an interest in it, which was also mocking her, because on any given evening there were a lot of guys who were dressed as Elizabeth Taylor at the bar. But in some sense, I do think that the issue of the woman is going to be the, and particularly now that women are in the majority raising children, without men. My optimism of that is that women are teaching men, boys, not to be afraid of strong women. My pessimism is that a lot of boys have not seen the experience of a gentleman as father, which I had and Ruben had, a strong father, but a gentleman. And I think that's an enormous deficiency that we have in our world. I would like a word as rich as Ms. to describe what I'm going to be doing at City Hall. I don't think I'm getting married. I don't think my other is a bride, nor am I his bride, and we are not husbands to each other. I need a new vocabulary, and I think women did it before me. They're just ahead of me. They're just ahead of me.
That's wonderful. One more question.
Hi. Hi. I wonder if you would care to kind of opine on the role of the woman outside of American and, say, perhaps European culture and in this vast desert culture of the Islamic world or other, say, religions in the world that seemed historically, at least, put down the self-sufficiency and independence of women.
Years ago, I was talking to a group called Dignity, which was a homosexual organization of gay Catholics, and forlorn because most of them were old and defeated and by a church that didn't want them. I said, you know, one of the things you should really be doing with your organization is expanding the focus of your concern, not with what happens to gay Catholics, but what happens to gay Egyptians today. 150 men were in prison today in Cairo. You should be, wherever you see a gay person persecuted, you should be writing to state departments or embassies and so forth. Today, right now, a woman in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, is getting in a car. They have been doing this for some time now. She is getting in a car and she is driving. She is probably middle class to upper middle class. She will be stopped by the police because she's not in the presence of a man, a family member. And they will wait with her until the family member comes to rescue her. They will be out tomorrow doing it again. I would like American feminists to be more aware of this, of a solidarity with these women, because it is happening throughout the Middle East, where women are beginning to at the cost of some loss to them. Malala goes to school in Pakistan. She knows there is danger here. She has been warned, and she goes to school, and she's shot in the head. It is going on around us, and the question is, can it happen fast enough, and can we be of any help to that? It seems to me that when there was a bishop, Ruben is having coffee with his bishop. I was having coffee for some time with the Archbishop of San Francisco, who was a very sweet man, William Levada, who became a cardinal in Rome in the last papacy. And from Rome, from his palace in Rome, he wrote this letter to American nuns saying that they're much too involved in women's reproductive rights and homosexual rights. He went after American nuns. And there was such an outcry from American Catholics, because we know that these women are the women who are doing the work. They're the women who are picking up. They're the women who are cleaning up. Oprah Winfrey tells this story on a Christmas, wherever she grew up. I'm not sure what state.
Tennessee.
Yeah, Tennessee. On a Christmas Eve, a knock on the door, and these three nuns at the door. She's not even Catholic, bringing presents, and she never forgot that. Never forgot it. There are so many people who have been touched by these women, and they die often ignored or bullied by bishops, or they're women. They can be mocked in Vanity Fair magazine, for being ugly. They are the feminists in our lives, and their freedom came in many cases in the late 19th century and the 20th century in Europe because they were dressed like Muslims. The women who educated me, you never saw their arms, you never saw their necks. They were in every way clothed, but that was their freedom. They could wander in places where men couldn't touch them, except for Bing Crosby. but it seems to me that what American feminism needs to expand its sense of what is going on in the world right now to give voice to these lives, because there are a lot of brave women. In Saudi Arabia recently, a very small item in the paper, a woman was stoned to death in a small village in Saudi Arabia. And she had been consorting with a man who was not her husband. There were women, by the way, in jails in Afghanistan for unbelievable non-crimes. And we have some leverage through our government, through protest, to protest on behalf of these women. This woman was being stoned to death. And while these men were heaving the stones at her, she raised her fist against them. And I thought, my goodness, that's revolution. And then she died. And I don't know her name, and I don't know what's become of her family, but I'm seeing it around me, as you are. Women who are raising children without men, the absence of men in this world, the evasion of men. And it seems to me that this is a clear sign to me that, as George Bernard Shaw says, we are headed for a civilization of she. And so we are. And so you are. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.